Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is no exaggeration to say that one of the men who has done quite a lot to shape the state of the war for the free world at the moment by serving in some of its most important capacities, certainly for the past decade, is our guest today for a full hour, I'm very pleased to say. He is Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. Today, he is the president of Griffin Partners and a counselor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But he's recently published a new book entitled Envoy, From Kabul to the White House, My Journey Through a Turbulent World, in which he talks about his service indeed in that turbulent world, initially as a special envoy to Afghanistan shortly after 9/11, as the U.S. ambassador to that country, the ambassador of the United States to Iraq during a very difficult time there, and subsequently at the United Nations as our permanent representative. The book chronicles these travels and gives us insights into today's world, the things that have happened since he left office. It is a delight to welcome an old friend and colleague and the author of Envoy to our program. Khalilzad, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Well, it's very nice to be with you. Thank you for your hospitality.
Zal, we've talked off and on over the past few years about some of the subjects that we'll discuss in detail today. I would like, though, to sort of calibrate, if we can. You're a distinguished diplomat, of course, a man who has studied deeply and lived in some of the most difficult places in this, what I call, war for the free world. You bring to it one other quality, and that is that of a Muslim. And I think it'd be very helpful if we could calibrate a little bit on, you know, your practice of that faith and how it has shaped or influenced or otherwise enabled you to deal with these difficult countries and problems over the past, 15 years, I guess.
Well, thank you. Yes, I was born to Muslim parents in northern Afghanistan, Mazar-e-Sharif. I was raised as a Muslim, a secular Muslim. My family was quite secular, although they practiced their religion, but they did not mix the religion and politics. And they emphasized the values of tolerance, of acceptance of other religions, and emphasized educating their children, both boys and girls. My sisters are also educated. I came to the United States when I was in high school and was amazed by what I saw and fell in love with it. And Islam or Islamic upbringing is part of my background, but I did what I did, whether it was in the State Department in the 1980s under President Reagan, in the Defense Department under President Bush Sr., and then in the White House under President George W. Bush, and then as envoy of the United States to various places that you mentioned, as an American representing America, American values, American interests in war zones. But it was more that I was an American that I did what I did. And Islam was, as I said, part of my upbringing and background, but it helped me understand the locals that I dealt with and also could respond to issues they raised because of my understanding. But it wasn't a it wasn't a decisive or a big factor in my diplomacy, if you like, and my representation of the United States.
Well, that's very helpful, Zal, and I think it helps in particular as we work through some of the places that you dealt with intractable problems, some of which, quite frankly, emanate from, you know, sort of the authoritative practice of the faith, which is very different than your own personal tradition. And I'd like to start, if I may, with Afghanistan as a prime example of this, a country in which the Taliban, of course, was for quite some time misruling in the most repressive, if Sharia-adherent way. As you began working that problem on the ground in the days after American forces helped to liberate the country, give us a flavor of the dynamic there. I note your involvement in, for example, helping to craft a constitution for that country, and Sharia plays a role in it. A sense of how this has shaped today's Afghanistan and what might be coming in the future.
The key thing, lesson to keep in mind that affects what you ask is that there is a crisis going on in the Islamic world or Islamic civilization or Muslim-majority countries, and that is the perception, the belief of many Muslims has been that Islam used to be doing very well, was even dominant, and then it has declined, and a debate has started for a couple of hundred years now that to describe what went wrong and then to offer a way forward. And Muslims have been very divided, and they have not found a way out and a consensus on a way out. And part of the response has been an extremist response, which is that the reason for the decline has been that Muslims moved away from true Islam, abandoned the Sharia, and do not live as they believe Islam was at the beginning of Islam. And that has involved also terrorists as part of the extremist wing. But there have been others who have been secularists who believe that the way to achieve greatness and success is to follow or imitate those who have achieved greatness and success, who have separated the religion from politics, who have embraced science and facts, and who have been open to ideas and criticizing what has not worked and being pragmatic in finding solutions. And there are schools of thought in between. The Taliban were among the more fundamentalist and backward fundamentalists, linked in some ways to the Wahhabi type or the Ubandi school of thought of South Asia. And they were quite backward. And then they allied themselves with Al-Qaeda, and they didn't turn over Al-Qaeda after 9/11 to the United States when President Bush demanded that. So we embraced the idea of overthrowing them and preventing Afghanistan from becoming a base for international terrorists such as Al-Qaeda again. And what my mission was when I went initially as the presidential envoy was to bring the other Afghans together, and the various groups, different ethnicities, because religion is one factor in Afghanistan, Islam, but there are ethnicity was another factor. Different Afghans were Uzbeks or Tajiks or Hazaras or Pashtuns, get them behind a progressive a constitution. And there was several issues that were dividing him, one of which was the role of religion. And at the end, they compromised on allowing Islam to be a source of for law and to honor international commitments that Afghanistan had in terms of human rights. But it was a compromise that we helped, but there were different schools and different ideas.
Zal, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to finish that thought, and we'll talk a little bit more about the decision to really invest in a federal form of government in Afghanistan and whether that is working out. That and more with Zal Khalilzad right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Our guest for a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio is Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. You know him best, I'm sure, from his service to our country in a variety of very difficult and often very dangerous capacities, including in Afghanistan and in Iraq, a little less dangerous, but no less difficult at the United Nations. Ambassador Khalilzad, again, welcome back. We're talking about Afghanistan, some of the hope for outcomes there. You were mentioning the compromise that gave rise to a constitution, a federal form of government, really, with sort of the focus on Kabul. Do you think that, in hindsight, it might have been better to deal more directly with some of these tribes and some of these various factions rather than try to forge a central government, which has proven difficult, to say the least, and now seems increasingly under threat from a renascent Taliban? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the constitution that the Afghans embraced was not a federal constitution. They embraced a unitary government constitution, and some have criticized that we perhaps should have imposed a federal constitution on them, giving different regions of Afghanistan autonomy based on ethnicity or tribes. But what happened there was that Afghanistan had, under the monarchy which ruled the country before the communist takeover in 1978 and 73 initially, and then 78, had a unitary form of government and was quite enlightened and democratic. And what the Afghans did, they were nostalgic about that period, because after the communists took over and the brutal war that the Soviets fought against the Afghans, and we supported the Afghans in their struggle against the Soviets, then we made the mistake of abandoning Afghanistan, and a civil war took place, and the Taliban emerged at the end, that the Afghans wanted to go back to that old constitution under the monarchy, except replace the monarch with the president, essentially like our system.
So you've described, and federal perhaps is the wrong word for this, but I meant a centralized government rather than one that takes advantage of sort of the various factions to try to develop sort of more direct partnerships with them. And the early returns were positive, I think it's fair to say. How did that translate over time, however, into the situation we face at the moment?
Sure. Well, I think it's fair to say that the tribes were convened, as well as different ethnicities, in a grand assembly that they call Lo Jirga, that approved this constitution. They were nostalgic, as I said, about the time that they had peace and stability. But what went wrong, in my view, was that Pakistan, which had strategic ties with the Taliban when they were in charge in Afghanistan, allowed the Taliban to reemerge in Pakistan and sanctuaries that they provided. And they began to challenge us and the Afghans from those sanctuaries. And we never found a solution or an approach that worked to prevent those sanctuaries or to destroy them for a variety of reasons. The kind of pressure we were willing to put on Pakistan was not sufficient, and the kind of formulas diplomatically that we wanted to, and we did pursue to get these two countries to cooperate, did not. And in my judgment, the mother of the problems that we see in Afghanistan today is really the sanctuary problem in Pakistan.
And really the character of the Pakistani government and the sort of double game that they've been playing, as you say, all these years. Again, our guest is Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, the author most recently of Envoy, From Kabul to the White House, My Journey Through a Turbulent World. And we're sort of tracing that journey. Pakistan remains, of course, a festering problem, both for the Afghans and I think it's fair to say for the international community more broadly, a country in which, as you know so well, Zal, there are large numbers, perhaps as many as 200, I think is a count I've heard, nuclear weapons, many of them perhaps poised for use against neighboring India. There's also reason to believe that they may be available for sale to other parts of the, perhaps most especially the Muslim world. But Let me switch gears and turn to one of the other places in which you served with great distinction, namely Iraq. We have watched, I think, with really a wrenching degree of frustration and disappointment, what's happened to that country in the period since President Obama chose to remove all U.S. forces from it. But give us a flavor of what you firsthand witnessed and helped shape in terms of what seemed so promising as a different kind of future for that country.
As you know, for a long time, during the Cold War, the approach to regional issues was defined or influenced by that huge struggle between us and the Soviets that you know so well. And we didn't pay a lot of attention to internal developments of countries. As long as they stood on the right side of that struggle, that monumental struggle, we had good relations with them. But then 9/11 demonstrated that the internal problems of the Islamic majority countries could pose a threat, as it did on 9/11. And we because of the weapons of mass destruction assumption that was there, that Saddam had them and was developing those that he did not, once we were there, we tried to help the Iraqis build a different kind of order for this region, a more democratic, a freer, and a consensus-built political order. And but there were problems. I think we made some initial mistakes ourselves by dissolving the Iraqi army and by going from liberation to occupation. I think over time we corrected those mistakes. We had to help the Iraqis come to a federal constitution there because the Kurds wanted to have their own region to run themselves. The Shia and Sunni, which, Muslims, Arabs, had been in a struggle for some time, and getting a compromise that would be inclusive of both, include both, took some effort, some negotiations with myself going back and forth between them. And with a
shuttle diplomacy, as I recall,
shuttle
it was
diplomacy,
called.
Exactly. And with some increase in our forces, President Bush, which President Bush authorized, we managed to stabilize and begin to make progress. But unfortunately, President Obama, reflecting his campaign promises prematurely and in a wrong-headed way, withdrew from Iraq, abandoned it, and that created the circumstances that produced ISIS, which now the problem of terrorism is a lot worse. The Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, is in the hands of ISIS because of that policy. And similarly, the policy in Syria created circumstances in which extremism and ISIS has grown. Perhaps based on wrong intelligence, we went in the WMD issue and we initially made the Bush administration some mistakes, but those mistakes were corrected. I think what we are suffering from now is the big error that the Obama administration has made in dealing with this region.
In addition to, of course, the problem of Syria and the Islamic State, in terms of the future of this region and Iraq most especially, there's also this natty problem of Iran. We'll talk about that and much more with Zal Khalilzad right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260. The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Sunday's New York Times Magazine features a fawning and chilling portrait of a disinformation campaign that's operated for 8 years at the highest levels of the U.S. government. Its object has not been to fool foreign powers or audiences. Rather, the point of propaganda campaigns orchestrated by senior Obama aide Ben Rhodes has been to deceive the American people. The paper credits Rhodes in particular with exploiting the presidency and the inexperience, incompetence, and sympathy for the Obama agenda of much of today's media to sell the nuclear deal with Iran. Rhodes manufactured a false narrative about when negotiations started, misrepresented the nature and terms of the unsigned agreement, and used a friendly, socially networked echo chamber to subvert congressional and allies' opposition. National security fraud endangers us all. Ben Rhodes is now exposed as its witting and damnable perpetrator. This is Frank Affney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
I'm very pleased to say our guest is Ambassador Zal Khalilzad. I have had the privilege of knowing him for a long time. I admired greatly his work both in and out of government, including in the Defense Department some time ago in the National Security Council. He's best known, however, for his role as an ambassador of this country in several difficult places. We've been talking about Afghanistan and Iraq. We'll talk about another one, the United Nations, in a moment. But first, Al, we were discussing the problem that has now come to afflict several states in the region, including Iraq, that was perhaps unnecessarily created by the president's decision to withdraw American forces from there. Perhaps it was something that would have eventuated in any event, but it certainly has happened with the diminution of America's influence and presence there, namely the vacuum of power that Iran has now substantially filled. I'd like to get your sense of what Iran's ambitions are, not just with respect to Iraq, of course, but more broadly, and the implications of the policies that the Obama administration has been pursuing towards that country.
Well, Iran has emerged as an influential power, and its goal is to be the hegemon, the dominant power of the Middle East and in the Islamic world writ large. And in that struggle, Iran is opposed by some regional powers, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, who see themselves as at the losing end compared to Iran in terms of building influence in the region. And our withdrawal, remember that during the Cold War, it was the region was competed over between us and the Soviets. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was a great victory for the United States, we became the preeminent power in that region. And with the Obama administration decision to withdraw and abandon, the struggle became regional, and Iran emerged preeminent, not only it gained additional influence in Iraq, and the response of the other two major powers of the region fragmented further, polarized further Iraq, but also caused what we see in Syria. And Iran is seeking preeminence, dominance in the region. Our nuclear agreement with Iran has signaled to the other regional powers that we are tilting towards Iran, if not embracing it. And we have not opposed Iran's regional policies vigorously enough, and we do not talk about the internal oppression that's taking place in Iran. All of that has been disturbing to our traditional friends in that region, who feel disheartened, uncertain, and some have reacted forcefully themselves, such as you see in the Saudi reaction, by supporting even extremist groups to stop Iran, Sunni extremists to stop Iran. And the region has become much more unstable and more dangerous than it has been for some time.
Would that include, in the case of the Saudis, support for extremist Sunni groups, the Islamic State, Zal, in your judgment, even though they are at least nominally part of our coalition against ISIS?
I think that I don't have evidence myself that the government of Saudi Arabia has helped ISIS directly, but I suspect the complexity of the Saudi system is such that it may be that that elements of the Saudi body politic and society, which have considerable resources, would have helped groups such as ISIS and other Sunni extremist groups,
yeah.
Because what they fear the most, the Saudis, and what they are concerned the most is Iran and Iranian policy. They see that as a life and death struggle, this leadership of the region, leadership of the Islamic world. And I say they it's not beyond them to do whatever is needed, including support for extremist groups in the, to block that or make that Iranian ambition unrealistic or unlikely. And this has been also the result of loss of confidence on their part in the United States.
And so when you look at the problems with the Saudis and specifically their concerns about Iran, I mentioned earlier that Pakistan is, of course, a nukes are us kind of operation, or at least it has been in the past. One of the great concerns about the Iran deal that the president struck has been not only that Iran will inevitably get nuclear weapons, may by some accounts even have them now, but certainly will, but that other nations in the wake of this deal, including the Saudis and perhaps the UAE and Egypt, who knows, Turkey, may also seek to acquire nuclear weapons. In other words, a great impetus behind nuclear proliferation. Do you share that concern? And if so, are there things that we should be doing about it at the moment?
Well, I think that what we did is in that agreement was to accept or legitimate a certain amount of nuclear capability that Iran could come to a year away from nuclear weapons capability. At least that agreement, assuming Iran subscribes and behaves consistent to it, and that's a big question. But even assuming they do, now the Saudis and others who are rivals of Iran are saying they need to move up to that level at the minimum. So we have, in a sense, opened the door to Saudi, UAE, and others seeking capabilities, including, as you know so well, the ability to enrich uranium. And once you have the ability to enrich uranium to a certain level, to master the rest is relatively easy. It's you can do on the side, maybe work on weapon design, on fuses, and so forth. So I think the proliferation or the spread of nuclear capability has been launched in the region. How it will end, it's obviously an important question, but that was, in my judgment, one of the weaknesses of the agreement, that it opened the door to others coming up to the level that we accepted. Iran, we underappreciated the implications of what we had accepted in terms of the capabilities that the others would seek in terms of nuclear capability.
I think in a way that may be the best case, Zal. My concern is that faced with the inevitability of a nuclear capability in the hands of their mortal enemies, most of these countries aren't going to fool with building the entire nuclear weapons, process. They're going to just buy a finished product from the North Koreans, if not the Pakistanis or somebody else. We're speaking with you, author of Envoy from Kabul to the White House, My Journey Through a Turbulent World. And we've just been touching on some of its turbulence. Zal, let me just ask you, if I may, about Turkey as well.
Can I add something, sorry, about the nuclear issue, if I might, which is that I met the Saudi King Abdullah a few times when I was ambassador to Iraq. I used to go there to ask for help to encourage the Sunni Arabs of Iraq to participate, and he often would also talk about Iran. And he said to me that if Iran acquired nuclear weapons, there is no way that we will not, and you better not come by you, he obviously meant the United States, and talk to me about exercising restraint. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, we will. And let that be very clear to you and to your superiors in Washington, was the very stark message from him.
I'm assuming that that message was conveyed both by him and by his successor after you left office as well. And it's kind of amazing. There's a story that will feature prominently in the Sunday New York Times Magazine about Ben Rhodes, a man I'm sure you've come across in the White House, and how he sort of conjured this deal and misled, I think, the American people and their elected representatives about it. But shame on us. We were all on notice. Zal, we have to pause for one last time. We'll be right back with more.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Every year, more American adults die from vaccine-preventable diseases than from breast cancer, traffic accidents, or AIDS. Vaccines like the one for pneumococcal disease can protect adults from illnesses that can cause missed days of work, hospitalization, and even death. Pneumococcal disease is an infection that can lead to pneumonia, meningitis, or even a severe blood infection. That's just one example of an infection that can spread from person to person. Getting vaccinated can help protect you and those close to you. I'm Dr. Susan Rehm of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. When I speak with my patients, I urge them to get all their recommended vaccines. Now I'm urging you to speak with your doctor to find out which vaccines you need. For more information about the vaccines that are recommended for adults and the diseases they prevent, like HPV, whooping cough, tetanus, and shingles, visit adultvaccination.org. That's www.adultvaccination.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined for a final, fourth installment of this very, very important conversation with Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, the author most recently now of Envoy, From Kabul to the White House, My Journey Through a Turbulent World. We've admired from afar his work in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and the United Nations. And I do want to come to that before we run out of time. But before we do, just one other quick burst from you. There have been some tectonic shifts, I think it's fair to say, in one of the other countries you alluded to there a moment ago, buffeted perhaps in part by what's happening in Iran, but also, of course, Syria, the migrants that they've unleashed on Europe. Talk a bit, if you would, about your assessment of Turkey, its trajectory as an Islamist, it seems, republic, increasingly now unmistakable and quite worrying.
Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, and his party is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood type of movement. There was initially some hope that his movement, the AKP, would evolve into what some believe would be positive as a kind of Islamic version of the Christian Democrats in Europe, and that it would be a marriage or a combination of a moderate interpretation of Islam plus democracy, freedom, competitive politics, free press, and civil society, rule of law. But increasingly, the Islamic Brotherhood element seems to be getting stronger, and the other values that were hoped for getting weaker, and the president, Erdogan, has become more authoritarian. And he has also become more drawn towards and focused on the Islamic neighborhood and seeking to build a kind of new Ottoman Empire in that region.
A caliphate, and, I think, specifically.
Or a caliphate, as some would say, as a brotherhood. And therefore, he too has been a big player in this great struggle that's going on for the future of the Middle East, and has become a player to sometimes compete with Saudi Arabia. Now they're cooperating more because the Saudis have been supporting more Salafist movements, and while he has supported more Erdogan, more brotherhood types, it's Turkey has emerged as a big player in the Middle East.
So let me turn to one other place where the Turks, by the way, have been quite involved, as you know, through, and the Saudis as well, this Organization of Islamic Cooperation. During your time at the United Nations, I'm sure that you had to deal with these folks, the largest bloc within the United Nations and arguably the most powerful. One of their agenda items, as you know, Zal, has been a 10-year program of action, they call it, to essentially prohibit and criminalize freedom of expression as it might offend Islam. And I just wonder, during your time at the UN and certainly what you've watched since, how concerned should we be that this sort of a transnational agenda is actually being adopted and advanced by the United Nations itself at the expense, perhaps, of our First Amendment freedoms?
I have to say that during my time at the UN, the OIC was not a very influential player. It was I tried to build up the Caucus for Democracies at the UN, but the groups that were powerful were more the Group of 77 and China, the Non-Aligned Movement, which although the Cold War had ended, nevertheless, there was a group of the non-aligned movement that was strong. The Arab group, a subset of the Islamic majority countries, was influential. Some of the other regional groups like Africa and Latin America and so forth were strong. OIC, which had an observer status, did not play an important role, and I actually don't remember who its ambassador was, because if they had an ambassador, but I do remember all the other key players. So if they have grown in importance, it's a more recent development in the United Nations.
Well, I fear that's the case in the Human Rights Council and now in the General Assembly as well. Zal, you had the interesting experience recently, I think took very commendable advantage of it, to talk about your new book on the occasion of introducing Donald Trump at the National Interest event recently. We have seen his star rise, needless to say. You had an opportunity there and perhaps elsewhere to interact with him a bit. I'd be interested in any takeaway you have from that experience as to his attitude and really where you think American policy has to go with respect to these various challenges we're facing in what I call the war for the free world.
Yes. Well, I think that America has an indispensable role in the world, and that indispensable role can be sustained if we get an economy that can sustain the kind of capabilities, security-wise, that can ensure that we not only protect ourselves, but advance the cause of freedom around the world. And that cause can be advanced, in my view, by us preventing hostile hegemony in three critical regions of the world, and that is the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. And all three regions are now under threat, and we need a national security strategy and a commander-in-chief who can embrace a kind of national strategy that would rebuild our defenses and have the right balance of power in Europe that can prevent this dangerous move by Putin to reestablish the kind of empire there. Although his economy is declining, but is, in terms of his military and his behavior is quite risky, and we need to make sure we can meet this threat on its own terms. And similarly in the Middle East, we need to support those who share our values, but at the same time oppose hegemonic ambitions by countries such as Iran. And in Asia, the rise of China poses a very demanding challenge, and we need to have a balance of power approach while also look to strengthening regional players who share our concerns to perhaps reduce the burden to an extent on us, and that includes India, and that includes Japan and Korea and others. So I think, in addition, we need to advance and support the cause of democracy, and I'm a little concerned that because of some mistakes that we have made, that we're emphasizing stability without emphasizing enough the support for freedom around the world. And we cannot have stability if there is no change, and we will have no stability and we'll have more problems without standing for our values as well. So I hope that we will deal with our economic issues, we will deal with our national security issues, and with our values appropriately by the next president. I had a short conversation with Mr. Trump. There are issues I agree with him, and there are issues I disagree with him, and I hope that once he is the nominee, or as he becomes formally the nominee, that he adjusts some of his views consistent to what you and I have talked about.
Zalmay Khalilzad, we appreciate your past service to our country and that you're rendering these days as the president of Griffin Partners. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon, my friend. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.